Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The president's got a new chief economist. We'll help sort out what he actually does. There is more behind the new number one bestseller than just a good story. We'll talk to Jonathan Franzen. And recession, country music style, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality. And by the American Payroll Association, in recognition of payroll professionals during National Payroll Week, September 6th through the 10th. More at nationalpayrollweek.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Friday, everybody. It is the 10th of September today. President Obama spent more than an hour with reporters this morning. It was mostly about the economy and mostly fairly boilerplate to boot. He wants to make things better, doesn't understand why Republicans don't, that kind of thing. There was a flash of news, but it went by pretty quickly. Austin Goolsbee is going to replace Christina Romer as the head of the Council of Economic Advisers. That's great for Mr. Goolsbee and all, but between the CEA and the National Economic Council and the OMB and all the other cooks in the White House economic stew, who knows what each of those folks actually do? Keith Hennessy does. He was an economic advisor to George W. Bush, so we've called him to help understand who actually does what on economics in the White House. Keith, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Kai.
Seems to me the division of economic advisors in the White House breaks down along economic policy lines and then the folks who do straight economics. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right. The NEC traditionally coordinates economic policy.
That is the National Economic Council, right?
Right. And then the Council of Economic Advisers is the more traditional PhD economists who often come from academic backgrounds.
Okay. So here's the question. Why can't you just have one person doing economics for the White House? Why do you need to break it down along policy and then the straight dismal science part?
Well, because economic policy involves both what you see in the textbook and the practical aspects of budgeting. It involves legal constraints, and then it involves, of course, in Washington, practical constraints on what you can communicate and what you can sell to Congress.
Give me an example, then. And yes, you were in the Bush White House, not the Obama White House, but there are probably some parallels. Given that Austin Goolsbee is now running the Council of Economic Advisers, let's look at the new proposal that the president rolled out this week with tax cuts and hopefully new jobs. How might that have started? Where did that come up from within the White House?
At some point, an idea is sufficiently interesting to the president that he says, I want to seriously consider this idea. And then traditionally, the head of the National Economic Council will pull together a group of the president's advisors, including the academic economists at the Council of Economic Advisers. If it's taxes, as it is in this case, probably the Treasury Secretary, the Budget Director, and basically bring all of those people together to analyze the different options, to describe the costs and benefits, so that when you go in and you're spending 45 or 60 or 90 minutes with the president, you're not wasting his time. You're instead talking about what the best policies are for the country.
We have been talking mostly about the internal White House staff, folks who see and work with the president most every other day. But there are a whole bunch of sort of outer ring players here that need to be mentioned. You've got the Budget Director and the Secretary of Commerce and the Secretary of the Treasury, Timothy Geithner. I mean, they all, in theory, have a vote on some of this stuff.
Absolutely. The sense that I get is that Secretary Geithner, even though he's across a little street over in the Treasury building, is involved in just about every economic decision and probably more of the economic decisions than you might normally expect for the Treasury Department. The Budget Director has his finger in absolutely everything. just because almost everything you want to do either costs money or involves regulations. And that's the budget director's job. And in addition, he's got physical proximity. For the cabinet secretaries, for Secretary of Commerce, Secretary of Labor, Secretary of Energy, a lot of it depends on how important their issues are to the president's agenda at the moment, and then also how successful they are at interacting with the president and the senior White House advisors.
Keith Hennessey teaches at Stanford University. He's also with the Hoover Institution up there. Keith, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You don't get something for nothing on this program, so now it's time for your quiz. We put together a new game on our website, Match the Economic Advisors to Their Job Descriptions. It's at marketplace.org, of course. Shouldn't be too hard if you were listening. No games on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you're in the mood for something a little different tonight, might I suggest something called Fashion's Night Out? It started last year in New York, mostly as a way to help retailers in the middle of a recession. Now it has turned into nothing less than a global marketing juggernaut with festivities from Hollywood to Europe. Everybody loves a party, of course. Retailers are hoping this one translates into actual sales. From North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin reports.
Many clothing stores in major cities will stay open especially late tonight for Fashion's Night Out. Expect champagne, red carpets, and designer meet and greets in many stores. Just don't expect discounts. This night is all about making the full sale. Simon Doonan's creative director at Barney's New York.
We're all in business. We're looking to make a buck, you know, wherever possible.
But Doonan wants shoppers to have fun, too. Barney's will feature fashion muses Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen.
We're having a karaoke contest with the Olsons. I've designed these flip-flops, which I'm selling. We're having musical chairs.
Even with tonight's party atmosphere, shoppers may keep their wallets closed. If August sales reports are any indication, consumers are worried about the shaky economy. Designer Nanette Lepore hopes Fashion's Night Out takes the edge off.
I actually feel a little more worried about what's going to happen to the world this year than I did last year, because last year you felt like, well, it's going to end soon. This year you don't know whether you can be as optimistic.
Lepore's clothes are sewn in the city's garment district. Tonight, her New York stores will feature seamstresses making skirts that say Made in New York. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
The White House and congressional Republicans have been going at it over the economy this week. Which tax break should stay? Which one should go? Who gets the blame for what's gone wrong? Perfect fodder for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Business writer Heidi Moore and John Carney from CNBC are here to do that with us. John, Heidi, good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
Ms. Moore, let me go to you first and ask you this question. Not about the president and what he's been saying, because frankly, he's been getting plenty of ink and plenty of airtime. But Robert Gibbs, his official spokesman, the White House press secretary, said this week that this election coming up is a question of whether or not you're better off now than you were in 2008. What's your answer?
I laugh at that comment because who is better off now than they were in 2008? I mean, unemployment is at record numbers. People are now talking, if not of a double dip recession, of an actual depression. And almost all of the economic indicators that you can look at genuinely say that we are in trouble.
John, what do you think?
I think that he was trying to get the investment banker vote. Wall Street is much better off now than it was in 2008. I think, maybe he was trying to get the 1% who they're threatening to raise taxes on to realize that that 1% is also doing pretty well right now.
Well, far be it for me to try to explain the White House, but let me try this question again. In 2008, we thought the end of the world was nigh, right? Now, we really don't, Heidi.
It's just because we've given up on hope. I mean, that's the only reason.
Or the audacity thereof. But yeah.
Exactly. We have the audacity not to believe in hope now. I think that it literally is just a psychological issue. Back then, we were running on adrenaline. It was really scary. It was a genuinely terrifying time. And what we found out is that things can stay really bad for a really long time. And you just can't panic all the time. So that panic felt bad. But what really feels worse is what you see when you look at people losing their homes still, underwater mortgages, the percentages growing still. And I think that's basically the answer. We've just been so beaten down that it's hard to see the way ahead now.
Well, about that, John, I mean, the president rolled out this new plan this week. Even if he could get it through Congress, which is debatable at best, would it do any good?
I'm not sure it would do very much good at all. One of the key things that he may actually be able to pass is this idea of 100% expensing for businesses that are spending money to buy new capital goods, make improvements in their factories. That might pass, and it might have a marginal effect of doing a little good, but that has a cash for clunkers problem in that we're robbing from the future. You convince businesses to spend in 2010, 2011 money that they would have spent in 2012.
Heidi, I want to get back to this issue that you mentioned of hope. Not far from giving up hope is this idea of despair. Is your sense that there is despair?
If you go out to certain places in America, I mean, the Midwest, right, you've seen for quite a while the cliche of the shuttered Main Street. Much to John's point about short-term thinking, what is the future, right? I mean, what causes despair is not being able to believe that something better is coming along. And we have no such proof right now.
John, let me pick up on Heidi's idea of giving up hope and ask you the mindset question. You know, back when the TARP was happening and the stimulus plan was being rolled out, at least part of what was going on was the government was stepping in to show the American people that, look, we are doing something, it's going to be okay. Is that part of what's happening right now?
I do think that the Obama administration wants to show that it is doing something. But because it isn't the sort of flash panic that was happening in 2008, we answered with the shock and awe of TARP. There's nothing that's sort of anything like that in the Obama administration's proposal. There's nothing that, you know, makes people think, oh, this is a real game changer. And I don't think for most of Americans, they're going to feel like it is going to change their life before the November elections or likely to change it anytime very soon.
John Carney from CNBC and his new blog there, it's called Net Net. Also business writer Heidi Moore. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, how they think about the economy down Nashville way.
I've got a song called Red Dress. It's just like kids in the job got you down all week long and you seem blue. Put on that red dress, baby, because you don't look good in blue.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 47 points this Friday, almost 0.5%, ended at 10,462. The NASDAQ put on 6 points, 0.25%, 2,242 at the bell. The S&P 500 added 5 points, 0.5%. Finish things at 1109. For the week, the Dow nudged up 0.1%. The NASDAQ and the S&P each climbed about 0.5%. American Eagle Outfitters soared more than 6.5% today. A few days ago, the chairman of the young adult clothing retailer bought 500,000 shares of his own company. Crocs, maker of those, one can only say, clunky plastic clogs, padded down more than 4% today. That natural gas line explosion near San Francisco rattled investors with Pacific Gas and Electric. Its stock fell 8% today. Price on 10-year T-notes slipped. The yield rose to 2.79%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At AllyBank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From from the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Treasury Department releases the federal budget for August. Time to break out the suit. Summer is over on the Hill. Congress is back next week. And its stars began solving crimes and prosecuting bad guys 20 years ago. Law and Order premiered on September 13, 1990. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The New York Times bestseller list isn't actually official until the Sunday book review section comes out, but if you poke around on the Times website today, you can get a sneak peek. Jonathan Franzen's new book, Freedom, is making what will undoubtedly be a prolonged stay on that list, number one this week. Today on our series, The Art of Money, what artists and novelists and others see when they look at the economy, a conversation with Jonathan Franzen. Jonathan, good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be on the show.
I don't often question an author's choice of title, much less a guy who's written books like you've written books. But I was wondering if you ever thought of putting a question mark on the end of freedom, because it seems to me that none of your protagonists in this book are especially free.
You know, I think all of my books come with honorary question marks after their title. I was hoping it would be assumed it was there. If you are going to actually take the things that are coming at you in the news seriously and you don't have a sense of irony, then you're going to get ulcers or you're going to kill yourself. To me, it's what the books I like are steeped in. It's a certain skepticism about the received meanings of words, the received wisdom about all sorts of things.
One of those skepticisms in this book is a questioning, a sharp questioning of the unhappiness, the imbalance, the doubts that come with this upper middle class existence that your characters, the Berglunds, are living.
I don't personally see it as a book about upper middle class ennui. I think the various characters all want things powerfully and are frustrated in not being able to get what they want, which is kind of the American condition, especially nowadays. It was a question that came up over and over for me in the last decade, hearing all of the talk about the terrorists hating our freedom. If that is really a good description of our international situation, why do we who have so much freedom, why are people so angry? Why do they seem so unhappy? That might apply to the Berglunds. They are certainly free relatively economically, and they have some free time, and yet they can't find a way to make themselves happy.
There are economic metaphors and outright economic statements everywhere in this book, and maybe the biggest one, the most profound one, are the views that Walter Berglund has on the issue of growth. I mean, it's a substantive theme throughout this book that we can't keep doing what we're doing in this economy and hope to make it last.
It makes you wonder about the economics that underpins our entire way of life, that it has no way of accounting for the limits to growth. There are all these externalities which classical economics simply ignores, and the most important one, and the one that's been most in the news this summer, is the environment. I don't have an answer to this, but I was certainly at pains to put a character in the book who is consumed by this problem.
I know it took you basically 10 years to write this book, but your timing literally could not have been more perfect. I mean, a book about growth and about these issues coming at a time when the American economy is stuck and growth is the key issue.
Yeah, not just the stagnant economy, but also the Gulf spill. And there you have it side by side. You want more growth, you're going to drill ever deeper in the Gulf. The deeper you drill, the higher the risk, the more catastrophes are waiting for us. And yet, what's the alternative? My job as a novelist is to create characters who have some depth and some life on the page, who can themselves then embody some of these questions so that it's not merely abstract. You see, these are actual problems that make life harder to live.
When I finally put this book down after having turned the last page, the emotion that was left was depressing, that these people and the lives and the stories that you, as you say, came up with inside your own head, it's all just depressing as hell.
Oh, my! Everybody at my publisher is tearing their hair hearing you say that. Great. Go out and buy this book. It's really depressing. I consider that a bit of a personal failure on my part as a writer, that even one reader saw no change.
Well, no, it's not no change. It's that they had come on this route and the circle and wound up at the same place. That's not to say no change.
Well, that is kind of the way of life, isn't
it? Yeah.
It actually ties, I think, in a way, into the question of sustainability. We have this notion in this country, not only of endless economic growth, but of endless personal growth. I have a certain characterological antipathy to the notion of we're all getting better and better all the time. And it's so clearly belied by our experience. You may get better in certain ways for 10 years, but one day you wake up and although things are a little bit different, they're not a lot different. And I think if one could get more accustomed to that somewhat more tragic view of life, that people would think, yeah, we don't actually need to have a bigger and bigger house and bigger car and more things in the house, that there might be some way to think of the world in different terms so that it was more about being and less about growing.
Jonathan Franzen's newest book is called Freedom, and it is a good one, by the way, I should say. Jonathan, thank you so much for your time.
A pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Every now and again, you hear a song that really helps tell the story of the times. We've got one here that we play when the markets are up. Back when it was written in the Depression, We're in the Money was really a hope for better times. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson was in the capital of country music not too long ago, Nashville, Tennessee, exploring how the recession and the recovery are being felt and heard in the heartland.
Well, I bought myself a rocking chair to see if I could lose these thin dime hard times, hell on Church Street blues.
Robin Bernard is singing me a song about the recession outside the honky-tonks on Broadway, arguably the center of the country music world.
Well, I gave a nickel to the poor, my good turn for the day.
The problem is, besides me and one of Bernard's friends, no one is listening. And Don Cusick knows the reason why. He's a country music historian at Belmont University.
You don't want any music that's going to make somebody mad. You want music that'll sell. Now, every now and then, controversy will sell. But by and large, you're going to play it safe.
I met with Cusick in his office, the same room where Tammy Wynette's hit song, Stand By Your Man, was written.
You know, most songs are about love, either getting it, losing it, or keeping it.
But Cusick says since country is the music of the white working class, the struggles of that group can be found in the vast library of country music records that line the walls of his office.
You can always look back and find a song, like you find Okie from Muskogee, or Stand By Your Man, the traditional values, or The Pill with Loretta Lynn. You've got, you know, so there are always those landmark songs. But they don't really dominate the music, but when one comes along and hits, it defines the music.
There are people in this country who work hard every day.
Like this number one hit, 40-Hour Week by the band Alabama. Released in 1985, Cusick calls it a salute to the working man in an economy that depended on manufacturers.
And it's time a few of them were recognized. Hello, Detroit auto worker, let me thank you for your time.
But as Cusick says, singing about politics or pocketbooks can turn listeners off. Who wants to hear a song about their day job during a night out on the town?
Okay, well, this is Here I Am. You want me to play?
Carla Davis is wrestling with that very issue. She's a Nashville musician who likes happy songs as much as the next girl, but she thinks it's important to put her finger on the pulse of today's society, even if it doesn't sell. Her song, Here I Am, deals not just with tough economic times, but also war. The risk seems to be paying off when Davis plays in small venues. She says you can hear a pin drop when she performs a song like Here I Am, one that connects with people's suffering.
It's giving people a message or giving them an experience that they've had before that they can relate to.
Other musicians in Nashville prefer to take a different route. They believe now more than ever, music should cheer people up.
I think sometimes people come to my shows to escape.
Steph Mahan is writing songs in her one-story Nashville house. I asked her which of her songs best illustrates the Great Recession.
I've got a song called Red Dress. It's just like kids in the job got you down all week long and you seem blue. Put on that red dress, baby, because you don't look good in blue.
Let's hear Red Dress. Can we do that?
Sure.
Okay.
Come on, darling, put your red dress on. Let's go dancing to some honky tonk. Kids in the job got you down all week long. You've been blue. Put on that red dress, darling. You don't look good in blue.
After our interview, Mahan pours me my first glass of moonshine, and I start to see her point. As one longtime country music producer told me, a down economy means hot sales for whiskey and happy music. In Nashville, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Jeremy's trip through Tennessee continues on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, this weekend with some people for whom the recession is just business as usual.
There weren't good jobs here in town, so when there's a downturn, people may say, what recession? We were already there.
Just for tonight, darling, let's pretend that we're out on a date and we're single again.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note for a Friday, something not on the news, but on the stories that didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Noonan, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, Brendan, we're fatter than we think we are.
That's not fat, that's storage.
Right. There's an article in Esquire magazine that looked at pant sizes. Everybody from Calvin Klein to Gap is basically putting smaller sizes on their pants than the pants actually are. And the worst was Old Navy, which said that a 41-inch pant was a 36.
Couldn't they avoid this problem if they took a cue from Starbucks and instead of using numbers, they just named their sizes after just Italian words?
Fenty pants! You could supersize them.
A khaki chino.
Matt Berger, senior web producer. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, Arthur Sulzberger Jr., the publisher of the New York Times, admitted this week that the New York Times won't be printed on paper at some point in the future.
Which is, as a journalist, I've been actually following this. That's a big deal for the newspaper industry.
The irony is that I was riding the bus reading this story on my Droid smartphone.
It's like, no duh, Sulzberger.
Though I will say, if they stop printing the paper, what are my kids going to do with all that silly putty?
Adrian Hill, Marketplace Sustainability Reporter. What's your story?
The McDonald's Happy Meal that doesn't mold.
The Eternal Happiness Meal?
Absolutely. There's a photographer in New York bought a Happy Meal more than 150 days ago, and she's been taking pictures, and it looks exactly the same as it did when she got it.
No mold, no nothing?
There's fries, there's a burger. It looks precisely the same as it did 150 days ago.
So this is like good news. I could include some Happy Meals in my earthquake kit, and I'll have a little silly toy to play with when I'm in my shelter.
As long as you've got enough water to counter the sodium, you'll be just fine.
All right, that's it. No more Happy Meals for my kids. I don't know what to tell you. That's Rico, Brendan, and just a tiny taste of their podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download. There's a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace on the radio from American Public Media on this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 47 points, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ put on 6 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 lifted 5 points, nearly 0.5%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. We will be back here on Monday afternoon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.